You're listening to SurgeCast, a podcast made specifically for busy general surgery residents. Okay, welcome back to SurgeCast, everyone. Moving right along in the section of esophagus, the next topic here is going to be GERD and Barrett's esophagus, and then we'll also kind of round everything off by talking about the anti-reflux procedures. Another very, very, very high yield segment here, and also very clinically relevant. So I'm going to start by describing some of the anatomy and histology of the esophagus. All of these points are very high yield points and very testable. So remember, the esophagus has no serosa like the rectum. And so the upper one third of the esophagus is made of striated muscle, while the lower two thirds is made of smooth muscle. And in terms of the blood supply, it has a segmental blood supply. It's one of the few places in the body that's like that. And you have to be able to kind of rattle these off for your test. So the cervical esophagus is fed by the inferior thyroid artery. The thoracic esophagus is fed by branches directly off the aorta, like the right bronchial artery. And then the abdominal esophagus is fed by the left gastric artery. The venous drainage is generally through the hemiasagus and asagus veins. There's a couple areas also of the esophagus that are kind of natural areas of narrowing that you should be familiar with. And so the first is in the cervical region, and that's the cricopharyngeus muscle. It's usually about 8 centimeters from the incisors, and it's the most common site for esophageal foreign body lodgment, and then the kind of resultant perforation from that. The second would be at the aortic arch, which is about 20 centimeters from the incisors. And the third is at the gastroesophageal junction, which is about 40 centimeters from the incisors. Finally, just a little bit about the LES. It's kind of a normal anatomic protection from reflux, and it's tonically contracted when you're not swallowing. You should be familiar also with the resting pressure, which is usually around 15 millimeters of mercury.
So let's dive in and talk about the epidemiology and pathophysiology of GERD. So unlike some of the things we talked about in the last lecture, GERD is outrageously common. It's up to 20% of adults who are going to have daily symptoms. Your risk really is going to increase with many modifiable lifestyle factors, obesity, tobacco, and many other pathologies can mimic GERD, including cardiac disease. So lots of those patients, you want to have a high index of suspicion for other problems. So the pathophysiology of GERD. So GERD is caused by increased acid exposure to the esophagus due to lower esophageal sphincter incompetence. That's mostly due to either decreased LES pressure or increased intra-abdominal pressure. So you want to think about something like obesity increases your intra-abdominal pressure, and then certain medications like calcium channel blockers or certain hormones can act directly on the LES and decrease the LES pressure. Remembering that prolonged gastric reflux does have an effect, which is it can lead to Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's esophagus is that squamous metaplasia to columnar epithelium that occurs. Intestinal type metaplasia is especially important because that is the only type which is going to predispose you to esophageal cancer. And that's a point that will absolutely come up on the abside on occasion. So the presenting symptoms of a patient with GERD, it's those classic kind of heartburn symptoms, kind of burning pain in the center of the chest about 30 to 60 minutes after meals, and it's worse when lying down. Patients can also have other symptoms like coughing, choking, or aspiration. In order to diagnose it, in a patient who has no other concerning symptoms, no dysphagia, no epigastric pain, and you're pretty convinced this is GERD, you can really empirically treat those patients with lifestyle modification and a PPI. Patients who need confirmatory testing or patients who you have concern for Barrett's esophagus are going to need a little bit more workup. That's going to include anybody you're thinking about possibly operating on. So a pH probe is the best test for confirmation of reflux events. Something that comes up occasionally on the abside is how do you kind of score that, and that's by something called the Demeester score, which is basically a global measure of esophageal acid exposure. The key number there is anything greater than 14.7 is diagnostic. You want to think about the possibility of doing an endoscopy on these patients. You need to rule out other pathologies that could be causing this, tumor, stricture. Endoscopy also allows you to test for Barrett's and identify the existence of a hiatal hernia, which could be contributing to the pathology in these patients. And then finally, because GERD can be associated with other disorders like achalasia, Some of these patients should go to manometry. That's going to allow you to have testing of the LES pressure and make sure that they have normal esophageal motility before you move forward with an operation that could kind of restrict their swallowing ability. Non-operative management. Obviously, the first step in management of GERD is lifestyle modification, weight loss, smoking cessation. Patients can elevate the head of their bed when they sleep at night. And PPI therapy is very, very effective and has really decreased the number of patients over the years that are going to need to move to operative treatment for this. Patients who you have concern for Barrett's esophagus need to undergo endoscopic surveillance, and those patients should have 4 quadrant biopsies at 1 centimeter intervals. And the frequency in which you do that is a highly tested abscite point. So low-grade metaplasia, that's every 6 to 12 months, versus high-grade intestinal metaplasia, those patients need surveillance every 3 months for esophageal cancer. And if Barrett's esophagus is found, then endoscopic eradication therapy can be considered.
Perfect. So I'm going to go into some of the operative management now. And so firstly, kind of the indications for pursuing operative management. Firstly would be kind of failure of medical treatment. So one thing to be kind of aware of is that if folks fall into this group, they kind of tend to have worse outcomes. Another thing would be that the patient just has a preference not to take any medications, or they're not able to take daily medications. And finally, someone who has refractory complications, such as bleeding, esophagitis, or strictures. Contraindications to anti-reflux procedures. So one would be active cancer, so esophageal cancer. Another would be Barrett's with high-grade dysplasia. And finally, kind of a big point, especially for the abscite or any other testing purposes, would be significant esophageal dysmotility, because that can result in severe dysphagia, especially after anti-reflux procedures. And remember that doing a fundoplication doesn't treat pre-existing Barrett's, and any additional endoscopic therapy which was warranted before would continue to be warranted as well. So when you're considering your options for fundoplication, there's 3 that you should be familiar with, the Nissen, the toupee, and the door. The Nissen is kind of what we're all most familiar with, and that's a full 360-degree wrap. The toupee is a posterior wrap, kind of like you'd wear a toupee on the back of your head. And the door is an anterior wrap, just like you'd wear or kind of maybe shut the front door. And so as far as the toupee goes, that's a 270-degree posterior wrap, and the door is a 180-degree anterior wrap. So next, I'll get into some of the steps here of how you would actually perform a laparoscopic fundoplication. One kind of guiding principle to remember before we start talking about this is that you have to have enough intra-abdominal esophagus to actually do your wrap, and that magic number is 3 centimeters. And so if you can't obtain 3 centimeters of intra-abdominal length on your esophagus, you need to do some sort of esophageal lengthening maneuver, such as what's kind of most commonly seen as a colus gastroplasty, where you just take a wedge of stomach and kind of create a little bit more esophageal length that way. And it's kind of hard to describe over an audio format, but it might be worth looking up a picture if you haven't seen that before. Okay, so you're in the operating room. First thing you're going to do is place the patient in reverse Trendelenburg position, take down the gastrohepatic ligament, and remember that while you're doing this, there is a chance that the patient might have some replaced hepatic vasculature, and this is specifically where you would find that replaced left hepatic artery or any accessory hepatic arteries. Next thing you're going to do is identify the right crus of the diaphragm and open the frenoesophageal ligament. Dissect that right crus off of the esophagus and continue circumferentially until you get to the left side, where you'll identify the anterior or left vagus nerve, where it's traveling along the anterior edge of the stomach. And remember that mnemonic from medical school with regards to the anatomy of the vagus nerves, LARP, so left is anterior and right is posterior. Next thing you're going to do is divide the short gastrics. And then create a posterior window behind the esophagus so that you can kind of identify the posterior, or again, the right vagus nerve. Next, you'll perform a crural closure. And the way you do that is you use interrupted, plegated, non-absorbable sutures. And the key here is you want to leave just a little bit of space there to make sure the patient doesn't have any postoperative dysphagia, so maybe a centimeter, centimeter and a half of space. And then finally, you're ready to perform your fundoplication. And so you'll need a 56 French or a 60 French bougie, and you'll kind of take the stomach or the stomach fundus and put it behind the esophagus and perform one of my favorite maneuvers, the shoeshine maneuver, where you just kind of take that fundus and you rock it back and forth behind the esophagus, and that kind of straightens anything that might be there completely out. And then you're able to perform your fundal plication. So if you're going to do a Nissen, it'll be a 360-degree wrap. And then you suture that in place, usually, by using three, again, non-absorbable pledgeted sutures using the esophageal wall. And I'll just say one last thing here, that an open procedure is very similar. The only difference is you might use a midline vertical incision, usually extending from the umbilicus to the xiphoid. But I would say this is one of the few procedures that is actually considerably easier laparoscopically or minimally invasively, because the view that you can get of that hiatus and your ability to maneuver behind there is actually a lot easier than the open procedure. And finally, just get into the postoperative care. So if a patient kind of complains of dysphagia postoperatively after a fundoplication, you might want to give them a liquid diet for at least a week and make sure that you're only slowly introducing solids. The one exception to that would be kind of postoperative dysphagia where they're unable to handle their own secretions. In that case, you'd actually have to go back to the operating room to kind of revise your wrap. And another thing to consider is gas bloat syndrome, and that's just recurrent abdominal pain and distension, and that's usually just due to air trapping. Okay, so why don't we conclude here with some of our high points. Number one, Catherine, what is the blood supply to the esophagus?
So the cervical esophagus is fed by the inferior thyroid artery. The thoracic esophagus is fed by branches off the aorta, mostly the right bronchial. Then the abdominal esophagus is fed by the left gastric, remembering that venous drainage is by the hemiazygous and the azygous veins.
Okay, and patient comes to you first time ever. You suspect that they have GERD. What are the first steps in the treatment of that disease process?
So remembering, if they don't have any other kind of really red flag symptoms, most of those patients can be treated with lifestyle modifications and PPIs.
Okay. And so when would you kind of move into the operative management of GERD?
So patients who have failed medical treatment, remembering that those patients are more likely to not have great outcomes from surgery. Patient preference to not take medications, or they just really can't keep taking them every day. And then any patient that has a refractory complication, like bleeding, esophagitis, or strictures.
Okay. And what's the difference between a Nissen and a toupee or door fundoplication?
So you're really thinking about how far around the esophagus that the stomach is wrapping. So a Nissen is that 360 all the way around. Toupee is just a posterior 270-degree wrap. And then a door is an anterior 180-degree wrap.
Okay, and finally, what is the recommendation for endoscopic surveillance in folks who have been diagnosed with Barrett's?
So you need to do 4 quadrant biopsies at 1 centimeter intervals. For patients who then show up with low-grade metaplasia, then they can be surveilled every 6 to 12 months, while patients who have high-grade intestinal metaplasia, those are the patients that are really at high risk for esophageal cancer, therefore they need every 3 months.
Awesome. I think that's going to wrap up this lecture. We'll see you next time.
You can find SurgeCast on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram or Twitter @SurgeCastPodcast or find us at SurgeCastPodcast.com.